see, the war started. The United States got into the war during this.
Well, the United States got into the war in 1941, December 1941. But all during the period that I was at the Rockefeller in 1940, and this is an interesting bit of history. Custom was, after lunch, you'd look into the library at the new periodical table, see what had come in that day of interest. And you'd look out at the window at the library at the East River, and there were all the land lease ships going out of New York Harbor up the river, knowing that a good many of them would never reach their destination. They would assemble somewhere off the Newfoundland or Nova Scotia coast and make the trip across to England or the trip across to Murmansk after 1941. And you saw the flags of every ship of the Allied nations during that period. And it was a kind of grim sight in one sense, enlivening in another sense. And then with the war coming along, the negotiations went on. And the Bergman decided to get into the problem of the reactivity of nitrogen mustards and mustards with proteins and amino acids and peptides. This was a kind of organic chemistry for which I was not prepared and not fitted. And at the meantime, I had gotten an inquiry from Squibb as to whether I'd be interested in coming out there as a biophysicist, biochemist in their blood fractionation program. That looked very much more attractive to me than working on chemical warfare problems, which I knew nothing about, and it was out of my kind of chemistry, let's put it that way. And the Bergman Lab, for essentially 3 years, spent full time working on the reaction of mustards and nitrogen mustards with proteins, amino acids, and peptides. At the end of the war, published a long series of papers in the Journal of Organic Chemistry that Bergman had died in 45. Fruton took the responsibility for getting that stuff through the hopper. So I went to Squibb and spent 4 years knee-deep in blood.
I remember reading that statement. Also, experimentally, it was a different experience, too, now dealing with large quantities of materials.
Well, it's a different world. Different world. You synthesize a peptide, and we're glad you ended up with 500 milligrams or gram, because most of the amino acids that you had to use for making these peptides, you had to purify yourself. Most of them weren't commercially available. And with the enzymes that you started out, if you started out with 100 liters of something, that was a tremendous, you couldn't possibly at most laboratories, you start out with 10 liters or 5 liters, you're glad to end up with a few milligrams of something. And there you're working on a totally different scale. Well, it was a marvelous experience to learn all that. And I had a good boss who was a good teacher.
That was
Tillman Gerlach.
It wasn't clear exactly what your responsibility was. What were you in?
Responsibility was threefold. One was getting into production. They were not yet in production. The stuff that Edwin Cohn's laboratory, the methods that they had devised, were largely devised by working on 5 or 10 liter quantities. We were going to have to work on 1,000 liter quantity. Scaling up was not a simple matter of arithmetic or multiplication. You had to devise new techniques, new ways of doing it. Moreover, we started out with a crew. Our shift superintendents were college graduates who had no experience with any of us. They wanted to take a job. They were largely 4F from the Army. They had some kind of physical incapacity, or in one case was a man with 3 children who would not be drafted because they were all very young children. And they had to be trained. They had to learn how to use a pH machine. They had to learn how to make up a buffer, and in quantity, and to check the pH. You had to learn how to make alcohol dilutions. You had to read your temperatures. You had to learn how to do all of this. And this was the kind of thing we had to set up. I learned how to cut pipe with stainless steel. I never had experience of plumber before. I'd built some equipment. I'd done some machine shop work. But we learned how to assemble the kind of stuff we need with 3/4-inch stainless steel pipe, because if we waited for the shop at Squibb to make this stuff, we'd be still waiting. They were so busy and so overloaded and didn't have enough skilled people anyhow. We got the equipment and we cut our own pipe and we made all our own assemblages. We did our own things. And we learned how to do all of the things from scratch. At the same time, we were training a crew. And we'd get one unit set up, and immediately the Red Cross would start delivering their blood. And we'd have to start going through this stuff to learn how to fractionate it and isolate all of the proper fractions that we needed to save and preserve and prepare in final form as pharmaceutical products. The major product initially being the serum albumin, which was in sterile 25% solution and the proper buffer and preservative in a neat little package in a nitrogen-containing tin can with the proper rubber tubing and the needle and everything else to be used for surgical shock or wound shock, and largely for submarine warfare and for landing groups. Couldn't carry whole blood. No way of preserving it. It was too bulky. You had to have something highly concentrated. 100C 25% was the equivalent of 1 liter, 1 pint of blood in terms of its anti-shock value. So we started out with that, and of course we ended up with gamma globulin, with fibrinogen and prothrombin and all these other things. So I got the experience of a whole group of plasma proteins, enzymes, blood clotting fractions and all the rest of it. And when I say we were doing the production work on the one hand, on the other hand, we were also doing the development work to scale all of this thing up properly in order to make it feasible, and beginning to do research on some of these fractions where there was no use for them yet or we didn't know how to handle them. So it was a combination of three different things. My wife always insists the best thing that ever happened to me.
Really?
Well, she said, you know, you were a cocky young guy and full of your own ideas and you knew how to work in the lab. But I came to a place where you had to get along with other people and train them. You had to teach. And one of the things I found is that I could carry on a lot of different tasks at the same time. So I had a production crew and a development crew and a research crew. And by the time I left, I had some 30-odd or 40 people working for me. And I found that I could no longer go in the lab myself to do anything. That's not what I wanted. And I was becoming more and more narrow and specialized, in a sense.
You certainly needed to have close contact with Cohn at Harvard.
Oh, yes. And I was back and forth during the war many times. Every time they got a new wrinkle, they wanted me to come up and see it. Or every time we got a new wrinkle, we had to come up and tell them about it. And they came down, but it was very close contact. And I got to know Edwin Cohn. Edwin Cohn I had actually met before, while I was a graduate student, because he and Selig Hecht had been graduate students at Harvard at the same time. And once a year or so, when Edwin was in New York, he would drop into the lab. That's when I first met him. But I really didn't know him well until the war years. And that's when, of course, I got to know John Edsel, exceedingly as well. And still one of our closest friends. John is now... will be 89 next fall. But he came to the American Philosophical Society meetings in April. He was in great shape, cheerful, lively.
He stops at the center from time to time.
I'm sure. Well, he was rather low for a while when his wife died. But he's back, good spirits. And he was out here. Oh, he was here. He came out to Caltech for the symposium in honor of Linus Pauling's 90th birthday. So he was out here in February. We saw him, and then we saw him again in April. But I got to know the whole group there, of course.
You commented about your superior. Can you tell me a little bit more about Tillman, what he was like to work for?
Tillman Gerlow was born in Idaho. His father was a guide and big game hunter. And he grew up in what were then the wilds of Idaho and went to the University of Idaho and was in his senior year when the United States entered the war in 1917. He was an All-American football player and went off to the wars, survived, came back with the rank of major or colonel or something like that. I could never get him to talk about it, but I gather he was plastered with all kinds of medals. And he was, to me, the prototypical Wild Westerner, because I didn't know anything else. He was the first real Westerner I had ever known. There was no smoking in the plant. I smoked at the time, used to go outside occasionally for a cigarette. But Gerlow didn't care that much for cigarettes. He was a pipe and tobacco smoker, so he chewed tobacco all day long. He was really addicted. And he had a very good English vocabulary, but he also had one of the best four-letter vocabularies I've ever heard in my life. He was a man who had very little theory, but a tremendously good instinct of how to do things in a practical way. He knew how to solve problems, in other words. And he had become the head of that division over the years, and simply in terms of experience. This was the division that handled all the protean therapeutic things. It was not responsible for the culturing of bacteria, for example, to make gas gangrene antitoxin, or tetanus antitoxin, or diphtheria antitoxin, or the isolation of the insulin. But once they'd gotten to the, in the case of the antitoxins, to the stage of purification, when after the animals were bled, all the preparation was done in that division. The insulin was obtained in crystalline form, but that was standard procedure, and we got the piles of crystals, and we got the responsibility of that dilution, the assay, the sterilization, the filling, and all the rest of the handling of any of the protean products in the squid plant at that time, the biological products. So I learned a lot about all of these things, obviously. And Gerlow was responsible, and that was the logical place to put the blood program. After all, the antitoxins, the antisera all came out of blood, anti-meningococcal antisera and that kind of thing. So I learned the practical side of all of these endeavors from him. And of course, we also learned all the manipulations you had to go through in order to get sterile, satisfactory products and be able to package and ship them off and deal with the suppliers. We had to get top priorities to get rubber tubing, gum rubber tubing. You know, not only was Pearl Harbor bombed, but Malay had disappeared into the hands of the Japanese. We had to get the right kind of glassware. We had to get everything. Everything had to be top priority. So I got to know all the Navy people who were involved in all of this. This was strictly a Navy thing at the time. Okay. The Army, after all, was going to be on land somewhere. They could use different kinds of things. This was Navy. And Marines, which of course was Navy at the time.
You also mentioned, well, there are a number of things here. You did some globulin work, which was published, part of the research.
From squid.
That's squid. Oh, yeah. But then you also had a key suggestion in the penicillin program.
Well, that was pure accident. I had gotten the job at Squibb when they were looking around for somebody trained in biophysics through one of the heads of their research institute, the Division of Organic Chemistry, Oscar Wintersteiner, whom I had known before at Columbia. Oscar was a very distinguished steroid,
yes,
antibiotic chemist. The middle picture on that wall.
Okay.
The first crystals of sodium penicillin, mm-hmm, when Oscar got an award from the American Chemical Society. Oscar had suggested my name for Squibb. He knew I might be looking for a job. And the head of the division at Squibb had come to see me at the Rockville to find out whether I would be interested. And at the same time talked to Bergman and then came in and offered me the job immediately. I was at Squibb all of about a week or 2 weeks and was just getting my own lab set up and beginning to get the stuff ready for the production end, which was not really in operation at the time. And Oscar came and asked whether I had time to go to a meeting. I asked what it was about. He said, well, you'll find out what it was about. I came and listened and heard about penicillin for the first time. This was a hush-hush research project. They could make it. It worked on bacteria, but how to accumulate enough of this stuff and preserve it. And I listened to all of the things that had been going on. They had tried this kind of stabilizer and that kind of stabilizer. And read the story. I said, well, why don't you try freeze-drying? And these engineers looked at me and said, what do you mean freeze-drying? You can't dry anything that's frozen. I said, yes, you can. Everything has a vapor. Water has a vapor pressure at all temperatures, even all the way down to absolute zero. And if you put it on a sufficiently high vacuum, it'll stay frozen because the heat of vaporization is going to keep it frozen while the water is coming off, and you end up with a dry powder. Well, how do you set this up? So I got myself a couple of Senko high vac pumps and got myself some glass, and we sealed up, got some tubes that we attached onto this thing, and pumped and pumped and pumped and pumped and pumped, after freezing them in a dry ice alcohol mixture, of course, and they got dry powders. Then they went to assay. As I said, that as much as I heard about it, until Oscar told me later that it worked. It was simply the fact that the only people who had been using lyophilization, as the name was called, were bacteriologists who were using this as a technique to preserve live bacteria, and protein chemists who had discovered that this was a way of preserving proteins without keeping them frozen forever, that you could dry them from the frozen state. And the patents had been taken out for the so-called lyophilization process from the University of Pennsylvania by Flasdorf and Mudd. I don't know whether these are patents, I'm sure long gone, of course. But it was the Flasdorf and Mudd process, and Flasdorf and Mudd were getting a royalty out of every, whatever the arrangement was, for every bit of stuff that we were preparing on the blood fractionation program, plus selling us the equipment we were buying. But Flasdorf was the engineer, and Mudd was the bacteriologist at Penn. So every time somebody had a problem at that place, I got called in. I was the problem man. And as I said, it was very useful, because when I went to tell Squibb that I was leaving in 1946, they wanted to keep me, of course, but I told them I wanted to get back into academic work, at least for a few years, to find out whether some of the ideas I had about working on enzymes were useful or not. Practically, it was not going to be of any importance in terms of industry, but I wanted to do some of these things on my own. So we parted as very good friends, and a couple of years later, they brought me back as a consultant because they found that somehow what I had been giving the company as a consultant working there was not being satisfied by the people they'd hired one way or another. And for the next 20 years, I remained as a sort of general consultant to the company.
You commented that all of this reputation as a troubleshooter sometimes, and people asking you to get involved in industrial problems was sometimes to your annoyance.
Well, because they wanted me to keep working on their problems.
Okay.
But I was a member of a different division, and I had to keep working on those problems. Well, you know, I had to go to Gerlo at one point and say, look, do you want me to work on their problems, or do you want me to work on my problems? Problems within our division. I can't be in two places at the same time, and I simply can't do this. And he said, okay, we'll cut it off. If they want to ask you a question, that's fine, but to actually get into the lab work of doing these things, that you can't do. Occasionally, I would come with a problem that I could solve in the lab in a very simple way. And I can tell you one very simple problem that I got into the last year I was at Squibb, which in retrospect just is ridiculous, the kind of problems that come up in industry. Having taught all those people at the plant how to use high vacuum to preserve proteins, they were making pituitary hormone preparations, which came with the buffer, and they were drying them in an ampule, and then the ampule of the saline solution or the distilled water or whatever it was that went with it, so that the physician who was going to use this could break the ampule, pour in the distilled water, dissolve it immediately, and use it. And don't ask me which pituitary hormone it was, because it doesn't matter. The fact is that they were doing this, and every time they reconstituted the hormone preparation, it was precipitated. They couldn't get it clear. And this is a product, after all, for intravenous injection. With intravenous injection, you can't inject anything with particles. It's got to be absolutely clear. And everything would go into a nephelometer to check. This is part of routine pharmaceutical manufacturing. I haven't even thought about this in long years. Well, they were stumped. They couldn't figure out what this fine precipitate was. It had some of the phosphate in it. It wasn't protein. That was clear. There was no nitrogen in it. So I got them to write down what this was, and very clearly this was a simple sodium potassium phosphate buffer, low concentration, with the right, so it made up to the right volume, as it was a physiological salt concentration was right. And I took one look at the thing and began to think to myself, to remember my inorganic chemistry. And the answer is that if you go back into the books and you dry orthophosphates at very high a vacuum, you make metaphosphates. You take the water out. You're splitting water out. And these things are insoluble. And we ran the control. A very simple control of simply using the buffer without any protein in there, the same thing happened. And I said, well, don't dry down to the point of less than 1% moisture. Dry it down and figure out a level that would stabilize at about 2 or 3% moisture, which is not going to hurt the protein any, that level of moisture. And you will not get metaphosphates. Well, it worked. They have been battling this for weeks. And I'm not saying I was all that bright, it's simply a question of memory, that I solved the problem in one day. This is the kind of thing that led to my being called on all the time.
I can imagine.
And that's why I got to be a consultant. Where over the years, when they finally ended up paying me more for a couple of days a year than I was getting when I left there, which is typical of industry, of course.
Oh, that's an excellent, excellent, excellent. It is. Why don't you make the connection with Utah? You were already determined you wanted to get back into academia after the war was over.
And I had told my friends that if they heard of a suitable opportunity, put my name in. And one of the people I had told was Abe White. I had told Joe Fruton, who knew that I was, because we had seen him periodically during the war, and a few other people. Sally Heck knew that I wanted to get back into academic work, but his connections with pure biochemistry were not that good. He was more in the physiological, biophysical side. And one fine day, I got a telephone call while I was in Squibb from Lou Goodman, who was a professor of pharmacology at Utah, and whom I had known while I was at Yale, while I was in New Haven. I have met him a number of times. We weren't close, but he knew who I was, I knew who he was. We'd have on a friendly basis, but pharmacology was not my thing. But he had come to Abe White asking for names of people who might be interested in coming out to Utah to join a big research project that was going to be devoted to muscle biochemistry in terms of the muscular dystrophy problem and things connected with it. And Abe suggested he call me and find out whether I was interested. Make a long story short, that was the basis of my eventually going out to Utah.
But as I understand, again, from what you wrote, there was it was really being built from scratch.
Well, this is spring of 1946. The war was over the summer of 1945. And people in Washington and around the country who were concerned was, what were we going to do about all the research efforts that had been supported by the ORCD and other government agencies during the war? The authorization for these was beginning to run out, and here we were in the middle of all kinds of research problems that were of interest to the medical community and medicine generally, the physical community and whatnot. What was going to happen to everything? One of the clear answers were to develop a research granting agency through the National Institutes of Health. The bill to create a research granting agency from the NIH was introduced by the senior senator from Utah named Albert Thomas. And it was introduced with the idea of studying a hereditary disease very common in Utah called muscular dystrophy. And Thomas had found out about this from the then acting dean of the Utah Medical School, the professor of public health, that here was a unique opportunity to study genetic disorders because of the polygamy, the fact that Mormon families were largely sedentary and had stayed there, and that muscle physiology was now advancing to the point where some approach might be made. So the bill that Thomas introduced was a $100,000 appropriation annually to support a muscular dystrophy program in the state of Utah, and it passed by unanimous consent in both houses. That kind of peanut money that the president signed. Then the NIH was created and begged the people who had gotten the grant to give them back $10,000 for administrative expenses. Never thought of that. So this grant was under the name of Max Wintrow, professor of medicine, as the senior investigator, but with the cooperation of Goodman, professor of pharmacology, and Davenport, professor of physiology, and Samuels, professor of biochemistry. It had four co-directors with Wintrow as the senior person, and with the idea of creating a biochemistry laboratory and eventually a clinical research laboratory to go with us.